Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife, conversations with artists and activists about death and life. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian. I live in Chicago. 9 and a half years ago, I survived a month-long coma, and I woke up with questions that I ask of guests on this show. They provide the answers, all the answers, forever and ever. Amen. Welcome to any new listeners who have hopped on board in the last couple episodes. Had Jeffrey Cantu Ledesma on a couple of episodes ago, Chris Giselle on the previous episode, and in those conversations, a couple things happened that I continue to build on in this conversation that you're about to hear with Julie Mitchell. What happened was when I talked to Jeffrey, things just got intuitive. I have some tentpole questions I tend to ask every guest. I threw most of those out when talking to Jeffrey, and then I reintroduced them in the episode with Chris, but we also got very meta about the show because I'm a DIY guy. This show is a labor of love for me. I spend a lot of time thinking about it, and thus it's going to come out in conversations when I'm talking to people about creativity and the work they're doing to imagine the world differently, including putting creative things into it. Now, with Julie Mitchell, who is a friend of previous multiple-time guest of the show, Ariel Elias, who recently made her Colbert debut, not her late night debut, but she was on Colbert recently. Julie was there in the green room. But this is sort of a new friendship dump. Julie and I had done a show in New York in 2015 together. And Julie is a comedian. Julie is a writer. She draws. She's a multidisciplinary artist. We talk about that. But also right from the beginning, we are kind of discovering that we take a lot of the same COVID precautions, and that is how we get into everything else. It kind of opens up from there. So this is very much, in this era in 2024, when you find out something like that, there is a lot of just like sort of survivors like peeking out of the foxhole, sort of like, oh, you're doing this too? Like, is it safe? We're comrades here, And so I think this conversation has that energy. And I left in the stuff where I am thinking through the format of this show, because hopefully it's interesting. I don't want to apologize for that, but if you have thoughts about that, if you're a longtime listener, if you're a new listener, hit me up. This Is Your Afterlife is on Instagram. This Is Your Afterlife podcast at Gmail. I am available for all those things. You can follow me directly, DM me. I want to hear what you think about the show. Also, if you want a very tangible way to support the show, a reminder that I produce it without ads or corporations. So if you believe in it, patreon.com/Dave Marr is where you can go. Pay me $5 or $15 a month to keep making it. And I also want to thank the Pigeon Level patrons who contribute at $15 a month. They are G, Barry Fontenot, Shubha Singh, Debo, Fred Fidowa, and Katie Llewellyn. And yeah, if you go on Patreon this week, you will hear Julie try to pitch me on Long Island Medium. So that's a thing to consider. Also, I have continued to include the link to the Chicago Abortion Fund Fundathon in the show notes. That is what I've got. I'm excited for you to hear this conversation. It was a blast to talk to Julie. And here we go. This is it.
I feel like that's why I don't judge other people, because I feel like everyone has math like that they're doing to calculate their own risk. That is like they're doing, that's the amount that they need to do to like remain sane and alive, for some people, especially people with kids, I think it becomes much harder because the kids are not masking at school. So then you're kind of just like fucked. So then I think people are just like, well, whatever. For me, I am doing as much as I like, for example, I wear KN95s. Do I know the research that says that a around the head respirator or like a better quality one is better? I do know that.
We're in the same boat there.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, what I'm doing right now is like exactly the amount that I can like feel like I'm protecting myself and feel safe, but I'm not feeling suicidal. You know, like I'm not depressed. I don't want to live anymore.
I know it's tough because I think I feel the same way, but then I also go, oh, but there is a line. You know what I mean? Like there is like, it can't just be completely up to individuals. You know what I mean? Where it's like, there are other people I know who don't do anything and that's their like math they're doing. And I'm like, well, I hate that math. That's the wrong math, you know?
That sucks. I mean, well, and this is bleak, but I feel like this is a podcast about death. So I feel this is, you're there. You're already there. That's what the people know what's happening here.
The people know.
My personal opinion is that we are in a window right now where COVID doesn't seem that bad to most people, because from what I understand, I mean, it seems bad as hell to me right now. And I know I'm correct, but I think there's enough people who do not fall in a window of vulnerability in their minds. They are not correct, but in their minds, they don't. And so they have like decided that it doesn't affect them or they, you know, it's calculable risk. I personally believe like from the studies that are coming out that are saying that this disease is more like HIV than anything else. Mm-hmm. So it's like the acute infection is not the issue, because I've met people now who see that I'm masking and they're like, oh, like, did you get COVID? And I'm like, yeah, I've gotten it twice because I have. And they're like, oh, was it really bad? And I'm like, no, it was very mild both times, which we're learning is bad.
It's scary. You know? Yeah. It's
scary and bad. And what I believe is that, well, the government is like failing us and has failed us because capitalism is like the organizing principle behind like all of our infrastructure, which as it turns out is bad when every structure you have built to protect people is actually profit driven. That's not good to do hospitals for money. It's like healthcare, but for money, sure. Right. I'm virulently anti-capitalist, which I'm sure your overalls tell me that you are as well.
Yeah, totally.
What I believe is that we are in a fixed time period where, and this is like in the 70s when tobacco companies knew that cigarettes caused cancer and they intentionally delayed like research showing that, and they litigated to fight that stuff coming out because they knew they would lose them money. Even though people were dying, even though they made a product that actively killed people, didn't matter. And so there was a window before like the general public, like before the knowledge of the general public aligned with like the facts, essentially. And what I believe is that we are in a window where, like, because COVID, it's like, people don't know what it fucking does because it just happened. And, like, it's 4 years old, so no one knows what, like, I just think all this is getting compounded. And I think a lot of stuff is being dismissed right now. Like, it's not being, like, the government has abandoned testing and, like, any kind of tracking framework. So a lot of, I think, COVID deaths that we're seeing and a lot of long COVID, it's not being categorized and like labeled as that. And so I think that that can work for a few years, but I think that the time will come when it's undeniable, like, A, how many people are getting sick, how, and also because COVID affects every part of your body on a cellular level, it manifests in different ways to different people because it affects the weaknesses in your body. So like if you already had like a thing in your knee, you're going to have a joint thing. Or if you already had something in your lungs, you're going to have a respiratory thing. So I think there's going to be like a period of probably 5 to 8 years where it like people are catching up to that. And then I think at like maybe the 10-year mark, people are going to be like, what the fuck? And I mean, we're already seeing like kids, like the levels of literacy have really gone down. Like kids are experiencing cognitive impairment from repeat infections from COVID. But all of this stuff that's happening is not being presented like or connected to that, except to insane people like you and me, insane,
yeah, who are
like, quote unquote, on the fringe, like, because we're like doing our own research and following like scientists on Twitter. I mean, I don't know what you're doing, but yeah, like, that's really what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And
which is not a hobby that I wanted.
No, it's like out of fear and it makes me feel bad.
Yeah.
But I would rather like feel bad and be like sad and scared than like unable to physically like, you know, like do stuff. And like, not to be ableist, like, but capitalism has no room for disability. It doesn't support it at all. I mean, yeah, I think in my heart of hearts, like, I think this could be, I'm ready for everything to change. I'm ready for global revolution where Palestine is free, and that then causes domino chain reactions to end
love this
all imperialism and colonialism and genocide like in the world and capitalism. And then we recreate society where like we center taking care of, supporting, and like, you know, helping everyone, you know.
Yeah, that sounds great. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I have some tentpole questions that I've asked folks for the podcast, but I had an experience recently that made me want to like redefine my relationship to those tentpole questions.
Cool. Yeah.
Basically, there was a couple episodes ago, I talked to this like kind of legendary experimental musician who's also a hospice chaplain, and we just like talked, and it was like, I was like, oh, this is cool. This is not that I feel uncomfortable with unstructured conversation, just that I was like, anyway.
And that's probably your skill. Like, you probably in the beginning needed the questions because you hadn't figured out how to.
Well, okay, to be honest, this is, I don't think so, but I think what the questions do is make it so it's not just a fucking comedian with a podcast. You know what I mean? It's like, like you believe in yourself and you're like, just trust me. This is going to be different. This is going to be interesting, but you need little extra. And I've gotten better, but this was my realization recently. And it's like, it's made my relationship to comedy, which I can't even say stand up anymore because it's like, it's a more, the last thing I did on stage was have someone draw do you remember the Monkey Christ?
No.
The woman in Italy who touched up the Jesus painting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. The answer is yes. I have never heard it called that, but I am so intimately familiar with the image that you're talking about.
Yes. So I love that. I also have been watching a lot of Ink Master.
Yeah.
Are you familiar? Okay.
I am. Yeah.
And so I just wanted to go on stage and have someone give me my first tattoo with a Sharpie, and I wanted it to be Monkey Christ. And so so it's like, that's not stand up. You know what I mean? Like, I can make them laugh, you know, but it's different. And so, the thing I came, cause we're all over the place, which is great. That's just what's happening. But
if what Jeff Dunham is doing is stand up, then that's stand up.
If Jeff Dunham is doing stand-up?
What Jeff Dunham is doing is stand up, then what you said is stand-up. I'm saying can't see anything.
And it is kind of, you just have to like, you know, I think it's a terminal uniqueness thing a little bit where someone asks you what you do and you want to be like, well, it's kind of this, and you just have to keep it simpler. You just have to be like, I do stand up. And then someone sees you and is like, oh, that's not what I was expecting. It's like, okay, well, now you know. You know what I mean?
Also, but I love the expansion of the idea of like, because stand up just used to be two things. It was like white guys like talking about how much they hate their wife, and white guys like making observations about the world. And that's all we had. And that was stand up for a while.
Right.
And I like that it's now like, It just could be anything, and that's better.
Totally.
Yeah.
But my sort of elite skill, I was like, okay, because I've been making these one-man shows because I was in this coma 10 years ago.
That's incredible.
Do you know about that stuff at all?
I looked it up. So you read my newsletters, and I read some stuff, and I found out about the coma. It also led me to look up, what is the longest time someone was in a coma and woke up? Do you know the answer to that?
It's a long time, but I actually do have a bit about this.
Hey, cool.
That I've become sort of judgmental about comas and that like it is because some people are like, oh, I was in a coma and it's like a day or two. It's like not a real coma to me. If it's medically induced, that's not a real coma. But then Grey's Anatomy will have you thinking like 5 months, 10 years, you know, these soap, and that's like too far the other way. And so the thing I land on is that like 1 month is the bravest amount of time to be. So that's, thank you for letting me do a bit at you, but that's the bit.
Basically. There should be more exclusivity in the coma community, I think.
Right. Yeah, I mean, or they keep it. Yeah. As also now a sober alcoholic, there are a lot of people who have coma stories, but a lot, they're very, not everyone got eulogized on Facebook during their coma.
And I read that you read those on NPR.
Right.
I want to listen to that.
Yeah. So that led to these one-man shows and that's been evolving the relationship to stand-up. And that has been changing what I think of as like my, you know, what do I, especially as a white guy, what do I uniquely offer? Right. And it's just the interview thing. You know what I mean? It's like not just, but like, like I'd be curious to hear your relationship to crowd work stuff, but that's been something that's been like really frustrating me because you have all these people in this room, the only time this specific group of people will be in this room together, and all you want to do is reinforce gender stereotypes by assuming any man sitting next to a woman wants to fuck her. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean.
Right.
I have so much rage in my heart for, I think it evolved organically, right? So it's like, you know, all the arts industries are now run by tech people who have no taste or soul. So now everything that gets made is because of numbers, like either because you figured out an algorithm and you have a ton of followers, or you did something, you have a ton of followers. It's like, I forget who, but someone said this amazing quote where it's like, it used to be you get in front of the right people and then you get the audience. And now it's, you need the audience to get in front of the right people. And it's just like completely dismantled. Real. I know. Yeah. And it's fucked and I hate it. The goalpost keeps moving, blah, 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 blah. So now I feel like a ton of people, and I don't even want to call some of them comedians because like there's a club, like when I was in North Carolina, my boyfriend is very into clubs, which I started in New Orleans. There's no club there. I don't even like clubs. And I probably shouldn't say that on the internet, but I just think they're bad for a scene. I think that they make it so that there's like a few people you're trying to impress. So no one's forming their own voice because they're trying to just get what the club likes. The clubs, like, bottom line is money because they want to sell tickets. They don't want the old white people who came to the show to be offended and ask for their money back. They want them to sit there and buy drinks and have a good time. So I actually am one of the few comedians who thinks that clubs are bad for comedy in general. I think it's like fine to have them in Manhattan for like tourists and like people like visiting and they just want to do something. But I think they're bad for the world and I think they're bad for comedy. But my boyfriend is into them because that's like kind of all there is in North Carolina. Like there's not a huge alt scene in North Carolina, in Durham or Raleigh or Winston-Salem or like whatever. There probably is in some pocket, but.
Asheville probably.
Asheville. Yeah. And actually Durham is very cool, but I don't know. The comedy scene in North Carolina, it seems like a feeder scene to me. It seems like anyone who is good moves. But hopefully that'll change. North Carolina is an interesting, I could talk about that too.
Yeah. We're back. Go back from, forget I got you onto Asheville in North Carolina.
And so, wait, what was the original question? I'm going somewhere. I have the momentum. I feel it.
I know.
Where am I going?
We were talking about, I was eventually getting you. Yeah, go.
I can remember. I was going to say, the people who headline that fucking club sometimes are TikTok people who can sell out the room and don't know what to do with an hour of stage time. Not know what to do. And it's like, some of them are better than others. Some of them are figuring it out. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm not hating on them. Like, make the money, sell the tickets, whatever. But that's not what stand-up is. Like, to me, and I mean, to me, stand-up is anything like that a stand-up does. Like, if you haven't done open mics for like 5 years and like figured out your voice and written stuff that's, you know, it's like, that to me is the thing. And so I feel like it started the crowd work shit. Like, there's an artful, beautiful way to do it. I started in improv. I have an improv background.
Same.
I think that my stand-up was the best when I was also doing improv, because it sharpened all of my, like, to be present, my reflexes, my like comedic timing. Like, it sharpened like all these skills that booster like the writing and the stage presence and, you know, the jokes. Like, I think they work in tandem really well. I think they're branches of one tree, blah, 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 blah. but I think that like a ton of people realized that there is an insatiable hunger for comedy right now. And there has been for the past like 5 years. Like, comedy is having this like boom. So it's like all this comedy is being put out and none of it is good. but like, a lot of it, more of it is being put out than is good. I think we can all agree with that.
Yeah. And there's always that like 90-10 rule or whatever, but it really does feel, it feels like 95-5 or 97-3 or something like that. But and for me, the crowd work thing is, so in the process of creating my most recent show, was when I had this realization about like, oh, my elite skill is interviewing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's, the show is also like about Survivor, cause I watched 40 seasons of Survivor in 4 months.
Yeah.
Thank you. And, so there are like challenges, but then there are also just like points where I'm practically bringing the show to a halt. Like, I'm just asking questions of the audience. And like, if no one volunteers an answer, we can go 30 seconds with, you know, like, and you know how long that feels, you know, we can go a minute, you know, of nothing, because I want it to be like, I want people to feel like something shifted. Like, it's not just like a transaction. And like, because the show was very much about like pandemic and like me trying to figure out why people are acting this way and like literally not having answers. And so like at one point I asked people where they're at with their COVID protections, like in the middle of the show, you know, and it's like, that's what I'm much more interested in doing. So the point being, I don't need the tent poles. Okay. I never needed the tent poles, Julie, but I have been. But the one that, if we get to none other of them, I think the one that would be cool to maybe frame some of the stuff we're talking about, is I usually save it for the end. I ask people like, "What's your coma?" Like a moment of transformation where before you're one version of yourself and after you're another. And you can choose anything, but I would love if you were able to talk about like, because the thing I've also been thinking about a lot is just like my relationship to creativity, and it's become like, I don't need it to make me money. And a lot of this has come from like talking to, ambient and jazz musicians on this show, where it's like the ceiling for that is not a mainstream ceiling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like, but I respect and that work has moved me so much that I'm like, okay, you can make like super high quality work and never be like a professional blah blah blah, you know? And so like, and that has been a grief, a transformation, where it's like rethinking those things. And I'm wondering, with the seriousness with which you have taken the pandemic, and specific, like, I don't there's very few. There's only one other person I've talked to, Whitney Wasson, a friend who's been on the show, but never this much in depth about like the pandemic, meaning I perform less.
Yeah.
And like, and so what is your relationship to the way the pandemic has changed your life, the way it has changed your relationship to the way you want to be a creative person? Does that make sense? Wow.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And I feel like this is the thing I've been cycling through like for the past 4 years with myself.
Yeah.
To like come to terms with, because I started stand-up in 2013. I was in my 20s. I'm 34 now. I was born in 1989. So whatever the math is there, I'm really bad with that. But like so what I sort of have realized is that so much of my identity is like, if I'm not a comic, I don't know who I am. Like, actually, yeah. Because like, okay. Yeah. There's so many things that you were talking, that you said that I really want. I had like a thought and I had a reaction to, and I'm trying to
and
think
I just
of
kind of steamrolled past those.
No. Like it's all connected, but in a really amorphous way. And I'm trying to think of like a narrative thread that could take us like through, but I might just like list things that seeming
just Jackson Pollock it, like throw it at the wall and we'll figure it out.
Who stole from his wife? Do we know that?
Okay. See, canceled Jackson Pollock.
Anyway, so yeah. So like my personal philosophy around comedy is that I think that art is one of the deepest and most effective ways to change someone else's mind about something. Because when people are like in the mood to laugh and they're laughing, their guard is down. So like if you're lecturing someone about something, they're getting really defensive. They're not listening to listen. They're listening to respond, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I'm sure you can tell I'm incredibly feminist. I'm like an abolitionist, you know, left of left. I'm somewhere that is uncharted. I mean, for white people, I'm sure black people are there and have been there.
Yeah.
But for white women.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I very intentionally do not use words in my stand-up to indicate to anyone what my politics are. I mean, I don't think it's a secret. I don't think people are thinking I'm a Republican, but I started in Louisiana, and New Orleans is obviously very like progressive or whatever, but I would intentionally do these shows in Mandeville, Covington, like red tiny towns. And I wouldn't say I was a feminist. I wouldn't use words that people already had an assigned thing to. Like, because when you can make like a room full of 70-year-old white men laugh at your period, like laugh at a period joke that you wrote, that is like humanizing and normalizing an experience that they have no access to. There is something like deeply, like it feels powerful to me. And in reverse, the reason I love stand-up so much is that I feel like that was my entry into like identity politics, like learning and understanding. Like, so when I was like 12 watching Comedy Central, a lot of my favorite comedians were black men who were talking about experiences I had obviously no experiential knowledge of, but even no access to, because society is very segregated. And actually, growing up in Durham, which is 52% black, like at the time, I think gentrification has sort of changed that. But, you know, I had black friends and stuff, but their parents weren't talking to me about race, you know, I was going to black church and being told to like sit down and stand up, but like they weren't explaining like, you know, these dynamics to me. But I would watch like the stand up of like this 20-year-old guy being like, you know, when you get pulled over by the police and you can't go for your wallet or whatever, like just things where I was like, wait, what? What is he talking about?
Right.
And that was sowing the seeds for me then later, too much later, I think, but later, to like connect that to an ideology, to be like, oh, everyone is not having the same experience as me because I have privilege. Yeah. And like other people are having a different experience. And comedy, like, I think also having like, you know, like my identity as white is privileged. My identity as a woman, like I experience oppression. So it's like, I kind of have a foot in the door to understand what oppression is because I have an intersection of my identity where I experience that. I think white men don't have that, like unless they're queer or trans or, you know, whatever. But so I feel grateful that I think that saved me from like being completely insulated from like understanding that in some way. I don't, anyway, this is where are we going? I don't know. But to me, comedy represents at its purest, best form. Because I think abolition is about imagination. Like, I think it's about imagining the world as something that doesn't already exist. And comedy is one of the quickest, most beautiful, in my opinion, ways to do that, to get there. Because you're just talking and you can create anything by saying it. Like, I feel so much power in that. Like, when I tell a joke, like, for example, when I first started, I used to be, and I'm still very afraid of being raped. That was like the biggest fear of mine. I don't know where, I mean, I know where it comes from. It's like the world, but I don't know why I specifically, like, I was just very scared of that. And I did, like, when I first started out, all I did was rape jokes, which is insane. Yeah. And I would do 5 minutes of rape jokes to mostly men who are like drinking at a bar on like a Wednesday.
Yeah.
But because I'm funny, like, they got it. And like, I remember, like, I used to have this thing. Well, you know what exposure therapy is?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would set it up where I'd be like, you know, a lot of people can use exposure therapy. Just like, you take the thing you're afraid of and you just like expose yourself to it more until you're not, but that won't work for me because my biggest fear is being raped.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't have someone like slowly rape you.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
Till it's not. And I would be like, and also like the people who say their biggest fear is like spiders or heights. You're not thinking hard enough because it's rape.
Yes.
Like,
yes. Right.
It's rape forever. Anyway. And so like, for me, like I told those jokes for like months because I was in New Orleans. I was alone. It was like mostly men at night at a bar. They'd be drinking. I'd have to walk to my car at night alone. And I was just really scared. And then, but if I got a room full of people to like laugh with me about that, I like felt safer because I felt like I made them see me like how I felt, you know, like mm-hmm. I made them see me like a person kind of, and like change them a little. A tiny bit.
So then did you start it with any professional aspirations or was it just out of a desire to, or was it pure expression?
A pure expression. I don't think I'm a professional person. I haven't had a go to work job in like 3 years. Yeah. I like all my emails, like, I don't know how to talk that way. I just like say like, oh, sorry. Are you mad at me? Like, I don't, I really struggle with that. I wear leggings like every day. Like, I have a master's degree and I've never even considered having like a job where you have to like, I think professionalism is also rooted in white supremacy, but like, you know, I don't know. I'm not.
What's your master's degree in?
Communications.
Okay, love it.
But it's an umbrella like degree, and I did my like capstone project in offensive jokes, actually.
Okay. Yeah. So there's not, it doesn't sound like, you know, because the thing I'm rooting and exploring as like, has there been transformation,
right,
for you around the pandemic is, has it doesn't sound like, you know, I've had to like to dissolve my expectations and ideas around the fame dream and like, I'm going to be on a late night couch and blah, 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 you know, and like, and realizing that like my favorite thing is my favorite entertainment in the entire world, filmed or not, is 3 blocks away. It's the Neo-Futurist Theater. I've had several ensemble members on the podcast.
I saw but that,
the
yeah.
Neo-Futurists do a show 3 times a week at their theater. Sometimes they go on. It's not about what they go on to do.
Right.
It's not like, oh, they're doing this to get to get JFL.
It's not a stepping stone. Like it's
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so like it is still a bit hard for me to wrap my head around that some people like started a thing and weren't like, so I'm going to become like the god of this someday. You know what I mean?
Yes, totally. Well, and this is like something that I kind of realized pretty early on is that I never want to be famous because every famous person I've ever met seems deeply sad in a way that is not good. My style of comedy and writing is like really hinges on hyper vulnerability. And that only works with anonymity. Like otherwise it doesn't work. Like the answer to your question, I've been like thinking about how I'm going to say it. The real answer to your question is deeply traumatic personal family things happened during the pandemic and it completely shifted my relationship with myself, with my family, like with my art, like with everything. It changed my life. I'm still dealing with it. It's bad, but I don't think that I want to put it on a podcast because I'll put this on my Instagram, which my mom can find, you know, like I don't want it to be connected to me on the internet because I don't want my brother to, or my family to be able to find it because this conversation between you and me, I'm able to be my full authentic self. I am not able to be that with my family in a meaningful way right now. And like, that's the shit. And like, I have already in my newsletter, I didn't write about that stuff for 2 years. And then I just realized it was like really eating me up. And I was like, this is a space I created for myself to process stuff. And I'm going to give myself permission to do that. And then whatever the consequences are, like, will be worth me like doing this for myself, like for where I'm at right now. And not immediately, but pretty soon after, someone shared it with a family member and they were livid. And it like damaged our relationship even further because they don't understand what I'm doing. They see it as very petty, as like to hurt them. It's everything is about them. They don't see it as in good faith trying to heal myself. They don't see that I have anything to heal from. They don't see that I could be doing anything that's not directly about them, that it's for me, you know, like, so like to return to the comedy thing, it's like, you know, I live.
And do you want me to cut any of that stuff out?
So far, it's good. So far, it feels fine. But thank you.
Yeah.
Because they know that it's like a weird privacy shame thing that comes with, like, I think people who, like, they're like, this isn't anyone's business. You're misrepresenting me, like, blah, blah, blah. Right. Like, where it's like my experiences in my life with a family member, like, it's my life. I have license to talk about it, but they don't see it, I think, that way.
Right.
They only see it as a reflection of themselves. And it's just like bad.
Fully not trying to blow up anyone's spot on any level, but I'm curious, is it like an event happened?
Yes.
Gotcha.
It's an event related to a dynamic that's been like escalating over time that like completely exploded. And then the aftermath of that event.
Okay.
So it's like,
Yes. Cause I both do like the last thing I'm trying to do with the death podcast is like get clickbait, you know, but then also I'm sure you can relate to the idea of like, but I want someone to tell me every single detail of their lives and everything,
for sure.
You know what I mean? So I appreciate that. Okay. So you're talking about your the relationship of vulnerability and anonymity and the lack of desire for fame, which I also just want to recognize that, like, a non-famous people saying I don't want to be famous is a lot of like me being like, I don't want to go to the gym because I don't want to like bulk up too much. You know what I mean? I don't want to like get too swole, you know?
Also, fame for women is bad. Women get stalked and harassed and
but fame for everyone is bad. Not to deny at all the imbalance there.
No. I agree. I think fame for everyone is bad. I think the culture around celebrity is really bad. Like,
it's horrible.
I think as a society, we have this like, I mean, with child stars, it's especially, I mean, female pop stars, child stars, like it's especially evident, but I think that exists with everyone, but it's like hyper, like what's the word where it's like you cook it down so it's just the essence of it. And that's COVID. The reason I can't think of that word is because I've had COVID twice. I'm getting dumber. Also, I love drugs and that's probably not helping, but I'm getting so dumb. Like, I used to be able to just, I would have a thought and all the words would like rise to the surface in the right order. And then I would just like open my mouth and they would come out and like everything would be connected by these invisible like things. I would never lose my thought. I would never like, I just was really coherent and like verbal. And I feel like now I'm just a rambling like psycho, you know?
You're still very verbal if that makes sense.
But maybe without the cohesion, ignoring it.
No, there's cohesion. But okay, so what I'm hearing from you is, I love living in New York. I love creating things. I'm just drawing and writing to make sense of my life. I'm not fucking pivoting from comedy or something in the way that I tend to overthink of things. You know what I mean?
But for me, there is a level I am trying to attain, but it just, fame just has nothing to do with it. Like, or I would be fine with fame to like a weird niche group. Like, for example, I have a Substack. My newsletter is a Substack. Substack has a paid option. If I got popular enough where, you know, 10,000 people wanted to pay me $5 a month to read what I wrote, I could live off that forever. Like that would be my dream. I also have a movie review blog that in a perfect world, I would be able to put on YouTube these video reviews that would be funny because I'm a comedian and I could make them funny that are like, you know, 20 minutes long and I could make money off the ads. Like if people just are like, yeah, what does this white bitch think about Madam Web or whatever?
Yeah.
Cause I love doing shit like that where, yeah, like I have been drawing and like, I love, and like, if people were like, yeah, I'll pay you $40 to like make a poster. And if like 100 people had that thought every year, like that would be great or whatever. Well, that's not enough money actually. But like, you know what I mean? If
totally like, the quantity that I actually have said, I think this might be like, I don't know what number of episode in a row I maybe have said this, maybe three. Maybe I skipped it the last episode, but I you know, detangling money from the equation, being like, I still, you know, audio editing, doing some, you know, helping create some sort of podcast thing would be great. I mean, I think I should host, but whatever. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be my specific thing that makes me my living. You know what I mean? Like it would also the Patreon for this show, if that was what did it, that would be fantastic. But with that not being the case, the thing that I've been thinking about is, okay, how much validation do I need? Mm-hmm. And it is, I base the quantity that I've come up with is I need about one person a month to reach out to me personally and tell me that the thing I'm doing matters to them.
That's,
you know what I mean?
Too low. That's way too low.
You think that's too low?
That's way too low. Yeah. I don't know if I'm just insane, but
No. I love that. I love that. Okay. I thought you were going to be like, what? Why are you thinking of it like that? But you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you just think I need to raise the bar.
No. If that's the right number for you, God bless. Like that's healthy. That seems like you have internal peace or something. Like,
no way, one a month,
that's fucking insane.
No way.
No, I put out shit all the time because I need, I think my relationship to validation is healthy for me. Like, I don't know if it's scalable for someone else, but just like how I know myself and like where it's at, it feels very good, but I do need more than that. Like,
yes.
When I post something and people don't like it, I get angry, like actually angry. But it's like out of frustration because I feel like I have a good sense of what I'm making and I feel like it has value. And so it's frustrating to not feel like that's recognized. But I think that there's a lot of factors for that. Also,
well, because the other option is you completely doubt yourself and you're like, yeah. No, you're like, I know what it looks like. I've seen people who are delusional and don't and don't know that what they're making is shit. And I could be bonkers.
Not me.
But that's not what's happening. You know what I mean?
No, and I think that my anger does come out of like self-protection maybe, but do not feel self-doubt like that. And because it's not to say that I don't feel self-doubt. I feel self-doubt all the time, but never about anything artistic. And it's not because I think I'm this like genius. I just think that everyone's art is valuable because it's only you. Like, you know what I mean? And I don't have to like everyone's art and not everyone has to like my art, but I think human beings are meant to be creative and expressive. And this is why I think capitalism is so bad, because I think that we've commodified these skills to be profit engineering. And so now it's like, we assign things. So it's like, oh, this is good enough to make money, meaning like other people would pay for it, or this is not. And it makes people feel like they then shouldn't do it if they're not good enough to make money off of it. But I don't think that that is the metric that we should be looking at art. I think that art is meant to make you and someone else feel something. And even if that thing is hatred, I think there's value in that because it's letting you know, like, even stuff that you're opposed to, you know, I think that that's valuable. I don't think people making like things with the goal of being making people angry is good. But I'm saying, like, if I see art and I'm like, oh God, I fucking hate this, I feel like it teaches me something about my artistic values or the kind of art I want to make. Not things that are like transphobic or something, but just like art that I think is ugly as shit. Like, you know, just a style that I'm like, well, this sucks. And then
also, and that's when you comment on their page. Thank you so much. I've learned so much from this piece.
It's a gift. That it was is a gift to me.
And they don't know. They don't know the way in which you're referring to it as a gift, but so they can kind of take it as encouragement. But well, you can say it as a cautionary.
When I have a really strong reaction to something, positive or negative, I like sit with that longer because I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Because I think that there's value. Like when I see something and I don't feel anything, I'm like, this is bad art. But if I see something and I feel intense hatred, I'm like, what the fuck is happening here? And usually it's that I hate that person's worldview and it doesn't match with mine. And I think it's harmful. But a lot of times, like, okay, museums, I think museums are perfect for this because you see the art first and then, but then you sit with it and it'll be a room of that person's shit, you know? And so it's like, I mean, sometimes you can just walk by it, but also there's little cards that are like, this is why I did this. This is what I was feeling. This is what I was going for. And sometimes I'll see it and I'll hate it and I'll read their little card and then I'll look at the rest of the stuff and I'm like, oh, okay. Okay. I see their wife had cancer. Like, okay. You know, like whatever it is. Or like, oh, they were like, or they say something and I'm like, oh, I actually kind of like this now. Like I am malleable. I am
totally
like really opinionated, but I think very, very open. Like I have really strong reactions to things initially, but I think I'm very open to like hearing stuff and being wrong. Also, I don't think my opinion is like, you know, I don't know. I do think my opinion is better than everyone else's.
Yeah.
Because it's mine, obviously.
But you're willing to change it.
But very willing. Yeah.
My thing is like, I just want to stake a claim and then we can move it. But I want to be like, fuck the, you know, we watched.
You know, it's a great example. Oh, what were you going to say? What were you going to say?
It doesn't matter.
I was going to say a great, great example is the movie Uncut Gems. Have you seen that?
Okay. Yeah. I saw it when my partner had COVID, actually. Very wild to be like living in the living room.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I saw that movie. No one, I just saw people loved it. People were loving it. I knew nothing about it. It was in the summer when everything was falling apart. People were rioting. I started the movie at 1 a.m. 1 a.m. Oh
my God.
In my dad's house alone.
Had you seen Good Time?
No. No, oh my God. I had no idea what I was getting.
Wow, no. Wow, wow.
I watched it. I was stressed. I was physically, like I had a physical reaction. I hated it. I hated it. I wrote a review on my movie review blog that was like, this sucks. I hate this fucking movie. I wish everyone who made it like experienced pain. Like I hate this movie. And I posted it on my Facebook and I got a whole slew of reactions. I got some people being like, oh my God, yes. And then some people being like, you're wrong, blah, blah, blah. My friend Leah, she wrote, I liked the movie because I think it shows what it feels like to be an active addiction. Mm-hmm. And I immediately was like, that's exactly what it is. And that's why I didn't like it. But it is incredibly well made, which I acknowledged in the review. Like I can acknowledge it's incredibly well made. I just hated the art. But then I was like, that is exactly what it is. And now it has value to me. And ever since then, I now see it completely different and I don't hate it and I respect it.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I've been having a thing recently with friends around movies where I will state an opinion and they'll kind of do the thing where they're like, well, that's just your opinion. And I'm like, it like throws me off a little bit because I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, yeah, of course it's just my opinion.
What else would it be?
Do I need to preface everything with like, this is just what I think? Like, I'm like, no, I'm coming in hot. You come in hot. We'll bang against each other and we'll figure something out and recognize that we're just talking about a movie. It's not personal.
No, people take it really personal. And I've learned or reflexively learned to just couch. So if you read the newsletter, like maybe you picked up on it, maybe not, but like, I'm very aware of it. I'm like hyper aware of it, but I always write like, I think, or to me, like I'm do a lot of modifying because people get pissed. Like,
but that's like also, see, I've gone into, I notice my instinct to do that. And in writing, I try to cut that because it's like, it's way.
I do go through and delete a lot of them. I leave some. I leave some of them. Well, I also leave some of them because I think I want to invite people. Like if I just say like, this fucking sucks, there's no reason for that, blah, blah, blah. I feel like it's not as inviting for someone to be like, oh, well, this is, but if I say like, I think that this was blah, 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 blah. I do think it opens the door for people to be like, I thought this, you know, which I want, which I I feel like anything that's subjective to me, like morality is not subjective. Obviously it is like in terms of what you choose, but the things that I have moral stances around are not subjective to me. So like, just like human rights, you know, who deserves to have rights? It, like, that's not subjective to me. So there's things like that that I have a really, obviously, a hard line on. But anything that's like, you know, like this art is good. It's like, okay, well, you know, or bad or whatever.
Right. Totally. I mean, the way it gets more objective for me is the stuff I hate the most is stuff that I am casting aspersions on the mindset of the creator. And it's a lot of the mediocre stuff that I'm like, this is cynical. This is okay. So I'm in a music league at the moment, which is like, there's like rounds of themes and everyone nominates some songs and it creates a playlist and then everyone votes, has a certain number of votes. And so it's just like a fun way to like, hear new music. But there was a round that was covers.
Mm.
And I guess I don't like covers that much because I was just like, so many covers are not interesting. They don't change the song enough.
Right, right.
Or like there's this William Shatner cover of a Pulp song. And it was so, I was like, dude, this is clearly made to hip up William Shatner.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and it's, and it feels, it's all idea. The execution is completely perfunctory. It might as well have been me telling you, oh, William Shatner covered Common People by Pulp, you know, and you're like, oh, ha, 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 ha. And you don't need to hear the song at all because you hear it and you're like, yeah, this is William Shatner covering Pulp. It feels like AI, like, and that feels so cynical and made me like so angry. Mm. And that's the kind of stuff where I'm like, fuck this. This is made for people who don't care about art. Ben Folds helped produce it. This is someone who makes so much money and you know what I mean? And then I'm like whipping everything into the same tornado of like trying to damn a whole entire part of the world. And maybe that's why people are like, come a little like softer like, with your movie opinions.
Okay. Yeah. Do you know Richard Cheese? Do you know who that is?
No.
Okay. So that? He does covers. But okay. He'll do popular songs and his Richard Cheese, Dick Cheese.
Yeah, yeah,
Pulp,
yeah.
His stage name. Yeah. He does it all like a Vegas lounge singer.
Yeah.
It's incredible. So he does Nirvana's Rape Me. And the intro, he goes, this one's for the ladies. And it's like, and it's okay. like, it's incredible. It's incredible. Yeah. I think that all art, has it's like poetry. It's like people who are like, I hate poetry. It's like you just hate bad poetry, which there's a lot of. Like,
yeah.
I firmly believe there is no art form that everyone would hate all of. Like improv comedy, it's like there's a shit ton of terrible dog shit improv. Mm-hmm. But when it's good, it's magic. You're like, what the fuck? How are they making a musical right now? They made it right now, like. And I think,
well, okay, no. Musical improv doesn't count, Julie. That is, there is no good musical improv. I'm sorry to
tell you. I'm going to tell you right now, there is.
Julie, I live in Chicago. I've seen the good musical improv, okay?
But this is just telling me that you haven't.
It's not, though. But I have, and it's not.
Let me tell you that I did improv at my college in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And our improv scene was incredible. I know Chicago, is like, Chicago is the best improv scene in the world. I know. Right. But I'm saying sometimes there's microcosms that are like really good. And the improv that we were doing at our college was like really, really good. I have no like qualifications other than like, I don't know, in Boston, they won like Beanpot like all the years or whatever, which is like an improv festival.
Okay.
Some of the funniest people from that when they graduated out started a small improvised play company in Boston that would do these like one act improvised play or no, three act improvised plays. They were incredible.
That's great. I'm talking about musical improv.
And I'm saying sometimes there was music because some of them were like musicians.
See, that's, I mean, we're on exactly the same page ideologically here.
Yeah.
It's just musical improv is the worst art form. I'm sorry. It's the number one worst. Irredeemably worst art form.
I disagree. I just think you've probably only seen like a show tunes cheesy kind of version of it.
And but I haven't. I've done it. I've seen it. I've seen one man musical improv. I've seen it all. And it's just, it's, I think maybe you haven't seen enough of it to actually realize
I think in the 15 extent years,
to which you're the
gonna
rot.
See something and you're going to be like remembering this conversation and you're going to be like, whoa, fuck.
I promise you, I will not be seeing musical improv in 15 years.
Well, who knows?
But okay. So let me then ask the question as if carte blanche.
Cool.
What's your coma? A moment of transformation where before you're one version of yourself and after you're another version of yourself. We've kind of been like, I kind of like threw some possibilities at you, but it's been a process of me kind of – examining expectations and assumptions that I had. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather you just kind of like hit me with it.
I mean, yeah, I think the most defining like event of my adult life thus far is the thing I said about my family. Something that happened with my brother. That, yeah, I don't feel ready to talk about, but I will say that it like made me examine my relationship with trauma in a way that I had not previously. I wouldn't have identified as someone with trauma or who had experienced that. There's a psychedelic assembly here. It's like a psychedelic library and event space. And I volunteer there sometimes. And they just had a woman whose name I'm going to forget. Maya Sheetree is coming to mind. I think that is right, actually. And she's a like neurologist, but also like she does stuff with mysticism and stuff. She's like an interesting bridge between like a Western scientific perspective and then like a more indigenous informed like spiritual kind of lens to look at whatever, anything. And she gave language to certain things that I had never like thought about and experienced. And like one of the things she was talking about was like the difference between big T trauma and little T trauma. And big T trauma is like things that everyone would agree. It's like suicide in your immediate family, incarceration, sexual or physical abuse. You know, it's like these things that anyone would point to and be like, yeah, that's traumatizing. Little T trauma is more elusive, and we're sort of just now recognizing it medically, like in the United States. And it's things that two people can have the same experience, but one person feels traumatized and the other doesn't. And it's because the way that it's defined is anything that like makes you lose your personal sense of safety. It's a little like nebulous, but I think that yeah. like recognizing well, then, that relationship.
Totally.
Yeah.
Let's focus then on, because obviously we've got this like hole at the center of like what the coma is, right? We can't be specific about it. So can you be specific about the ways that you're different on either yeah. on either side of that?
Yeah, totally. One is that I understand the movie Magnolia now.
Okay.
I watched it and it was raining frogs and I was like, oh yeah, I get this. I know exactly okay. what's happening here. This isn't okay. strange to me at all. I mean, in a bigger sense, I feel like the dust is still settling on what that all looks like. Like, and in a lot of ways, I feel like in the process of rebuilding my identity, because all the certainty I had before, I actually no longer have. And that is kind of from COVID and Palestine and not doing stand up. And like, I mean, I lost friends like from October 7th who are like anti-Zionist Jewish people, because I like wrote this thing about what I was feeling and what I wanted to share, because I was sharing all these like political infographics and I wanted to like sort of explain like where I was coming from so that people had a context for it, like my friends who I knew from fifth grade or whatever. And so so I wrote this like thing, and in explaining that, like I am very like I was like, I support Hamas, like which I do, because like any violence in reaction to oppression, I don't think it's fair to criticize. Like, and I'm sorry those people died, but like we cannot look at it like a tit for tat sort of thing. It's like you can't ask people to live in a situation where they don't have freedom for 75 years
right.
and expect them to also all the people they elected to be normal and handle in a peaceful way were killed by snipers. Like they did the March of Return, where they would walk in their fenced in area to the fences and Israeli snipers shot and killed over 200 people. So like, I'm sorry that they like bombed a music festival, but like what else it's not. Also, all the people condemning Hamas are like, I just don't like violent. It's like, it already was violent. Displacing people is violence. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, like, but I feel like when I was a feminist in college and my feminism was like more centrist, and it was like, anyone who doesn't vote is bad. It's like, right, that's more palatable. But now I'm like, who cares about voting? Like, it's not going to save anything. Like, there's two parties and they're the same fucking thing. Like, there's just a different phase for the same policies. Like, Biden is a racist, genocidal, the policy, we're losing abortion under Biden. Like,
right, right.
You know, and like, I don't know. And yeah, I don't know.
I'm no, sorry. Totally, totally. Like,
But yes.
But is that, how does that relate to this sort of loss of certainty, and the sort of ways in which you feel different pre and post this family stuff?
Because the self-righteousness I had around my own anger, like, and just like, I think prior, I just had these like really clear identity markers. It was like, I understand my family. I understand my comedy. I understand like how I think and what I believe and what I feel. And then just over the past 4 years, like all of that, literally all of that has been eroded. The only thing that stayed constant is that I love taking pictures of dead birds. That it's like, oh, well, here we are again. Look at you. Look at that.
Oh my God. That is the only thing that stayed constant.
I
mean,
I'm sure there's other ones.
No,
like,
I know.
I feel like that. It's like, that feels unchanged. It's like in 2004, if I saw a dead bird, I would take a picture of it and I would post it probably. And then now if I see a dead bird, I feel like I'm home. I'm like, look at this is going to be me one day. Also, I love that they're usually, you can't see them usually. Usually they're in flight and they're scared of you and they fly away. But when they're dead, it's like, they're right there. I can see everything.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. It makes me think about my own mortality. Anyway, so that's like one of the only...
Have you read that John Updike story, Pigeon Feathers?
No. Is it going to make me change? No, what is it? What is it? I can't lose this. This is all that I have.
No,
support.
No, I think it's, I think it's basically, I mean, it's one of, it's hard to say like what a short story is about. It's,
I love a short story. Like, I'm writing this down.
About everything and nothing. Okay. Yeah. I only read it once, but it's very,
okay. I'm excited.
It's like a kid looks at a dead pigeon and realize how beautiful it is. And kind of, it's like, there's some vaguely like, I wouldn't say like, you know, post-millennial evangelical Christian undertones, but there's some like, there is some transcendent feeling of like, if each of these pigeon feathers can be so unique and beautiful and blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
then it's a sort of pointing to a higher power of some sort.
Oh, yeah. I think I feel that. I'm very like humbled and amazed by dead birds and all dead animals. Like even a rat, I take pictures of those. I have a highlight on my Instagram that's just dead, and it's all the dead animals I find. I like them. They, yeah, are important to me.
Because they're reminders of mortality.
It's like to see something that's dead that used to be alive, I think is rare, like especially because of like how we deal with death, like in our society, like it's so sanitized and like weird, you know, like some cultures have a sky burial, which literally means they just leave you on the top of a mountain and let birds eat you, which is what I want, or to be a tree or something or burned. I don't know. But like, I feel like there used to be such a connection to the cycle of life and like, and I think that's better for everyone. Like right now it's just like your aunt was alive and then you saw her in the hospital and it was really, really scary. And then she was just gone. And then you saw like a stiff over makeup to mannequin version of her potentially in an open casket funeral that was traumatizing. And now that person that you loved like doesn't exist and that's it. And I feel like there's no respect for death, like in that way, because you're just trying to make it be something else. You're trying to make it be like aesthetic, like, or approachable or something. And it should feel sad and scary, but in a way that's organic and like related to you. you know, like that you're connected to, not that you're disconnected from. Does that make sense? And I, well, does it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I realized that I said it rhetorically. And I was just like, that's what the dead
animal makes feel. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense because especially the thing you said about it being sad and scary in an organic related to you way, because I think one of the big sort of like drivers of this podcast is my death for me now, and especially 3 years ago, is as rape was to you when you started stand up. You know what I mean? So it's like, so I'm like, let's fucking do this, you know? And like, I just want to, I also, my like blood sugar is a little low. So I'm like,
kind you of need like to eat something. Out.
I don't think so. Let me test it as we're talking here. The feeling you have when you're on stage and you're like, I just need to speak to what's happening in the moment right now.
Yeah.
Is like,
I do that.
It's yeah, of course, but it's such a fucking double-edged sword in an edited podcast because it doesn't hit the same
way. Let people know you have low blood sugar. This is
I know, but it doesn't people aren't there with you and like, oh, thank God he said. It's just like it trips up a little bit.
I think it's nice. Maybe someone had to go to the bathroom during the podcast, and this is the part where they can do that.
I mean, you can bring your listening device in the bathroom.
But then there's the noise, you know? Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, how I do it.
No, but the relationship to a person relating to death is one solution to the sort of gaping maw that I have had around death, because a lot of that is about the disappearance. Your aunt, you see her in the hospital and then she's gone. And when it's this big unknown, death is already so unknown, right? Mm-hmm. So, but there are ways to make it by actually bringing it closer. It becomes less scary, I think, in some ways.
Totally. And it's normalizing it, it's familiarizing you with it, you know what to expect, like it's the same for everyone, like on a level. Also, I mean, I think what I recognize in what you're saying, because I'm this way, it's like something that's scary to me, I move towards. But I think other people, something that's scary to them, they keep distance from. And I think that makes it worse, because when I move towards something I'm scared of, I learn more about it. I like figure out my relationship to it. And I reach like a peace or a stasis internally, like that allows it to be something that I just have, instead of like this big, like anxious, like fear, because it's unknown, you know?
Well, what do you hope happens when you die?
Great question.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. What do I hope happen and what do I think happen? I mean, I see the framing, but I think they're the same, because I just think that the power of the mind is so strong. I think whatever you think happens when you die is what happens when you die, because I just think your cells and body and everything are just, I don't know.
What is it for you then?
I just think we're all like sand and rain and stuff, and you just go back into the universe, and then you get formed as a different thing. You know, it's like a theory. What is it? It's called the wave theory or something, where it's like,
right,
a single wave in the ocean is formed, and that's you, that's your life, but then it just becomes the rest of the ocean. That's what I believe. And like, a version. Reincarnation is like, seems oddly specific. It's like, first you're an ant, and then if you're good, then you're a cat or something. I mean,
it's just like, it's like a version of, I don't know why she swallowed that fly, sort of like, you know, like
I'm sure this is offensive to like people whose actual religious So like,
please, our understanding of it, as white kids growing up.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. I don't think I believe in like karma and like but in a loose kind of sense, because it, then if we look at Palestine through that lens, it's just like, well, that's obviously not true. You know, like, I don't think
sure
bad things only happen to people who deserve it on like a karmic level.
Right.
I don't believe that at all. But I do believe, like, and this is probably privilege that I can believe this because I've had like luck in my life. But I just think, I don't know. I feel like I don't believe in nothing because that feels lonely to me in a way that I can't describe or explain and don't want to sit with even for more than 1 second. Like, I don't believe in that, but I don't believe in like a white Santa Claus God with a beard who's like in robes, like looking down being like, you are good. You masturbated and you are bad. Like, that's insane to me. I feel like I believe like that everything is connected and everything is energy and and you are me and I am you and I am the microphone and I am the dog and the bed. And like, that's why I think that community is so important, because it's happening to all of us and there's just stuff that's wrong and we should protect everyone, you know? So
yeah.
What do I believe happens when we die? I don't fucking know. I think
you already said it.
Sandra, I said it. Okay. Said. Okay. Good, good, good. That's, what I said is an answer.
Does it freak you out to imagine one of the big gaping maw panic buttons for me is no consciousness, thinking of losing consciousness forever? Does that, the idea of like your Julie-ness ceasing to exist, does that fuck you up?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
Okay, the only time that would be scary and the only thing that's scary about death for me is if it happens before I feel like at peace with myself.
So what do you need to do to feel at peace?
I need to like find, I feel like I found my purpose and I don't totally know what it is, but I feel like my purpose is learning and creating and sharing and like participating in that cycle publicly.
That's the show. Go to patreon.com/DaveMarr to become a This Is Your Afterlife patron. Thank you to This Is Your Afterlife house band Lake Mary for all the music in this episode. Thank you for listening, whether first time or long time. Tell a friend who would love This Is Your Afterlife about the show. And if you listen in Apple Podcasts, write a little review. Those make me feel very good and are nice to know. Also, there are all the other ways in the show notes to tell me the things you want me to know about the show as well. And follow Julie and read her stuff and look at her stuff and enjoy her stuff. And until next week, remember, you are a mist.